So they like the idea of having a diverse, a minority in that position, but then almost like buyer's remorse, all of a sudden they saw how you handled situations and they go, I don't know about this guy. Or I mean, is that fair?
I think that's part of it, but I also think, you know, I'm a weird duck. And part of it is, if you're hiring me to clear the floor of people, one of the issues was there were board members who weren't crazy about the high school principal. And when I interviewed, I made it clear to them, I'm not a henchman. I'm a builder. If I come into your district, I'm pretty creative. I'll work collaboratively with people. Let's see what we can become. But I'm not the executioner. And yet that became a driving thing. And one of the things that led to my being pushed out as well. I saw improvement in this particular administrator, and so I was not going to be, you know, judge, jury, and executioner. So I think in that chapter in the book that I'm pretty honest when I talk about some things I believe might have been race, but who knows? That's the funny thing about this. You don't know.
You don't know what's inside people's minds.
You don't know what's inside their minds. You don't know what their motivation is. You know, if, and especially today, because to be honest with you, people are not, I digress for a minute. The other thing that the civil rights lawyer made clear is, yeah, if people are dumb enough to call you the N-word, it's discriminatory. But in our day and time, that's never going to happen. So what makes it especially hard to tell if something is intentionally discriminatory or racist is people are smarter than to do something that is obviously untoward. And so that makes it difficult, too. The book has helped me to move on from that circumstance. But it's funny. Given what's going on in our society, the issue of race has taken on a level of prominence in the last few years that to where it has to be one of the top two or three, along with terrorism, it's got its prominence is moving up the chart, whether it's violence against police that's race-based, on the part of the African-American man in Dallas who shot the police officers because they were white, or whether it's the questionable shooting in Minnesota, that issue has come to the forefront at a level that I haven't seen for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think everybody was lulled into a sense of complacency. President Obama was elected, good. You know, we can check that off the list. Now we've had a black president. And so, you know, a woman will be next and then a Hispanic and then, you know, we'll go down the list until we're done with it. And yet things have not gotten better. They've gotten worse. And I think you can tell where I'm at politically in the book. I will not blame the president, however, for that. I think that what's happened is all of these issues are clandestine. I think because of the fact that unlike the 60s and the 70s, where you might have gotten into heated discussions, but everything was put out on the table, and you said stupid and ignorant stuff, but people weren't as thin-skinned. My friend Frank Michalowski told Polak jokes, you know. I have Italian friends who, you know. So it's like we talked about all of that. And we shared how it felt to be a particular. Today, people don't talk at that level at all. So I'm not going to blame the government. I'm not going to blame the president. I think it's more grassroots than that. And when you see some of the shootings that happened, Walter Scott in South Carolina, you know there are underlying issues. And it would be disingenuous to believe it's only with police officers. With those rogue cops who've done that, and they make up such a small percentage of police, but with those rogue cops, they're just indicative of attitudes that have gone underground, and I don't know how you're going to drive them to the surface. I just don't. I think outlawing all speech, which unfortunately is where we're going, it's not going to drive them to the surface. It's going to drive them even deeper underground, and you will see those attitudes and those prejudices acted out, unfortunately, in some ways that are violent, and other ways. If you owned a business and if you honestly believed that blacks were inferior, guess what? There are ways of not hiring anybody of color. You can't publish it on your on the front door, but there are ways of still doing those things and engaging in that kind of discrimination under the table.
Milton, moving forward, I know in the epilogue, and even in the book, you reference Ferguson, you talk about Eric Garner. Obviously this week and last week, very recently, we've had multiple incidents where, as you mentioned, the race issue is not going away. And in fact, it's vaulted to the top, maybe right under terrorism, maybe right above terrorism for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
Are you amazed that we're at this point in society after, witnessing what has gone on the last couple weeks?
Not really, because, one of the things that I talk about in the book that's related to the state of Wisconsin is the number of African-American superintendents. So let me tie that into the question you just asked me. If out of 424 district administrators, if only two are people of color, because to be honest with you, I'm not familiar with any Hispanic superintendents. There may be one. There's one guy whose surname is. So maybe one, okay? But I don't know for sure. And so that's indicative to me of a total lack of progress. When I did my superintendent's licensure at Stritch, at the same time people were going through the doctoral program at Stritch, and there were a good number of African-American administrators. And you know what? They have their doctoral degrees. Some of them have their doctoral degrees. Some of them have their superintendent licensure. I've been to the state conferences for superintendents. I never see any of them. Why? They're not applying for jobs here, or they're not getting, and they may be applying, but they're not getting interviews. And so consequently, because of that, if you want to see progress, real progress would include executive level positions. If you looked corporately and you showed me how many executive vice presidents there are who are people of color in Milwaukee corporations and larger corporations in Wisconsin, and if the percentage, and I'm not a big quota person, but I'd lay $100 on the table that you can't, unless it's black owned, you can't find a business where it even approaches the percentage of the general population. Matter of fact, I wouldn't put the $100 on because it would be rhetorical. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact that that's true. So I think that that's more indicative of the lack of progress. If we were making real progress, then what we would see in leadership and policy positions, we would see blacks and Hispanics who were involved at the state level, at the governmental levels, who are helping to make decisions, especially in towns that are larger, where some of the issues concern people of color. And since I've gotten to travel in different circles, I can tell you that's not happening. So am I surprised by it? No. You know, I was one of the few black superintendents when I was superintendent of Beloit. At one point, there were four of us. Now there are two. If for some reason they decide to fire one of the other two, I have no confidence at all that they will be replaced by people of the same color. So, okay, so you're an African-American citizen. You look at what I just described. You look at key positions in society. Eliminate the president, okay? You look at other positions. You look at the Senate. You look at the House. You look at the governor's mansions. And very rarely do you see anyone that looks like you. So pretty much the message is, if you aspire to high levels of authority and power, you need not apply, because it's just not going to happen. And if you're a bright young kid and you're aspirational, you still need to see that it's a possibility. I think I mentioned in the book, fortunately with my brothers and with some people that my parents knew, I could see that there were African-American attorneys and doctors and in other positions. So it helped me. My dreaming was not in vain. Somebody else had already been there. So I think that shows the lack of progress. It's, you know, I have one son, Matt, who I describe. Matt believes in a meritocracy and a level playing field. And I've had to hammer him with, if it was level, there'd be more representation, and there isn't. And he says, Dad, your views are liberal when it comes to race. And I said, don't insult me, you know. But yes, I said on that issue, they really are, primarily because I haven't seen the kind of progress over my lifetime that stretched a pretty good period of time. I see fewer in some places than I might have seen, let's say, in the 80s, where I thought we were making some progress.
You mentioned previously, as we were chatting, that people nowadays seem more thin-skinned than they used to be, than a generation or two ago. In the book, you talk a lot about religion, your faith, and how you've carried that with you, and that has helped you not forget, but move past and turn the page and just go, all right, well, tomorrow's a new day, and I trust my faith, and I trust what I believe, and I have a goal, and I'm going to continue to move forward in that goal. What is that an important tandem for not just African-Americans, but all minorities and other people who feel oppressed? Is there seems to be less and less people of faith than there used to be, and it's a powerful tool to help people cope and things like that.
That's a great point. When you think about the civil rights movement, it was led primarily by ministers. The most prominent people in the civil rights movement, especially in the first number of years, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Martin Luther King, a lot of the people who were sitting at the counters and, you know, being dragged away or marching, they were also people of faith. In the African American community, the church took the lead where civil rights was concerned. As a matter of fact, let me tell you, if you hadn't had people of faith, somebody beating on you would have gotten beaten back, regardless of the threat of death. They just wouldn't have had the internal strength to be able to bear up under that kind of oppression and that kind of hatred. And so I think that it's one of the missing elements now. You know, my parents and their generation were people of faith, and I think what's happened is that a real faith in God, a real trust in and faith in Jesus Christ, I think the black communities become more and more secularized. And I think because of that, some of the moral strength that allowed past generations to overcome, I think that it's lacking. I think it's easier then to be involved in violence. You know, you don't have... I have a restraining influence. My faith in God, my fear of God, hold me back from levels of hatred and force me toward the grace of forgiveness. If I wasn't a Christian, if I didn't believe the Bible, there wouldn't be that kind of... I would feel 100% justified in some of those circumstances I mentioned in the book. You know, to give way to hating and to bitterness and all of that. But I just, you know, I can't go
there. Would
you
be where you were today without it?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, one of the things that I mentioned a little bit in my book, I've pastored two churches. My churches have been diverse, primarily white congregations, but also mixed congregations, because they know that if they come to the church that I pastor, you know, race is not an overt thing. The Bible and faith in God is an overt thing, but they know that they're going to feel comfortable because they're not going to be forced into the all-black congregation or the all-white congregation. Someone once said, Sunday mornings are the most segregated hour in America. It's still true. Because people skew along racial lines as far as their church attendance. I've been blessed to pastor churches where that's not the case. And to have good friends who were a part of that church who knew the very real possibility that if our kids grew up together and if they maintained those relationships through time, they'd probably marry each other. And so there would be Hispanic and black and Hispanic and white and Asian. There'd be those kinds of marriages that would come out of the relationships that the parents had. Because again, and I've had people in my congregation who are now reading the book, and they said, you know, it's really funny. If I want to think of you as black, I've got to consciously force myself in that direction. Now, see, some people would be insulted by that. I'm not. Because biblically, that's the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to, there's supposed to be a connection to being part of the family of God that transcends race, while still dealing with issues of social justice and issues of discrimination. The church is called to speak to those things. The church is called to be an influence in those things. But the church is, and you know, but when it comes to my operation and my relationship with other Christians, no, it's not to be race-based at all. It's to transcend that.
A big issue statewide, and has been for a number lately, is support, lack thereof, for public education in Wisconsin. We've seen more of a shift and more dollars normally that would have gone to public education, to private education, charter schools, things of that nature, from a legislative perspective. What's your thoughts on where public education is heading and that particular issue here in Wisconsin?
Having worked for both Racine Unified and Kenosha Unified, so two larger urban districts, as well as for Beloit, the achievement gap, because that's really the biggest issue when it comes to public education and people of color. And the fact that we're sitting in a state that has one of the lowest graduation rates for African American males. We're not talking about Mississippi. We're not talking about Alabama, Louisiana, the usual suspects. We're talking about a northern state. By the way, the other states who also are in the same category happen to be Big Ten states, the states that represent the Big Ten Conference, which is mind-blowing to me because my parents moved north for more opportunity, and it's proving to be exactly the opposite. So, you know, when I look at, full disclosure, I ran 21st Century Preparatory School, one of the few charter schools that's independent outside of the city of Milwaukee. So I have a little bit of background in that. I guess my view of the issue is a little different, and my view is this. If I was an African-American parent and my neighborhood school was a failing school, I would do anything in my power to get my kid to a school that was going to posture them for success. And if that had Catholic on the front of it, if it had non-denominational on the front of it, if it had, you know, public school on the front of it, as a parent, that would be my obligation. I think that the one reality, pragmatic reality for public schools is because of vouchers and other things, you'd better be delivering a high-level education that causes poor students and students of color to have the same eventual opportunities as white students, because if you're not, you no longer have a monopoly on them. They can go other places. So again, I'm a little different when it comes to that. And I believe in the mission of public schools, but I also believe if we were talking about the school district in Detroit or in Washington, D.C., and if you said, Milt, you're going to get a new job in Washington, D.C., I would not put my kids in the public schools. By the way, the president didn't either, and most members of Congress don't. So their rhetoric is one thing, but in reality, because they have more money, they have choices. They don't choose the public schools when they're failing. They choose the public schools only if they're high level, only if they're succeeding. And I think that public education is at a crossroads, and that the crossroads has to be, you know, what do we do to help all students succeed? But those who are considered the least of us, how do we really make a difference in their lives? And if the answer is we make no appreciable difference to posture them toward a much better future and a much better trajectory toward success than what they're experiencing now, then those parents have the mechanism to choose other alternatives.
Is it as easy as saying, well, we just need to invest more public money into public education? Is it a matter of finding a strong leader who's going to steer the bus or the ship, so to speak, in that right direction? I know that in Milwaukee they've had a lot of issues recently. I know Damond Means was given in charge of this commission to oversee it, and he recently resigned from that position. They got a lot of problems there. The achievement gap, as you mentioned, is wider than any place else in the country. Is it one answer? Is it a multi-pronged effort? And how do you go about fixing it?
This situation is so complex. The family's part of the issue. When I was growing up, I knew very few black families where you didn't have a mother and a father. And the data bears me out as far as the percentage of babies born out of wedlock. When I was a child, I think it was less than 25%. Now it's 75%. Some of the things that impact achievement of kids in school and their role in society are self-inflicted wounds that we've created in the black community. That's a talking point some people don't want to engage in. They need to engage in, because it also impacts the issue of poverty. If I'm making $15 an hour and I'm a single mother, I don't blame single mothers, so I'm not into the blaming the victim. But if I'm a single mother, I make $15 an hour, guess what? If I'm a single mother, if I'm a woman, and I've got a husband, and we're both making 15, guess what? We're making 30. And the chances that our kids are going to grow up in debilitating, unbelievable levels of poverty are minimized by the fact that you've got a two-income family. So that's one issue. And I'm sort of spinning off different issues. I think that the other is being willing to use whatever curricular means, whatever instructional means, whatever tool you have to. I think that when it comes to instructional methodology, that we're stuck in a rut, And because it seems somewhat discriminatory to use more direct teaching methods with black children, there are school districts that won't use it, even though those students come to school farther behind. They don't know phonics. They don't know rudimentary math. And unless you're willing to do whatever it takes to catch them up in the first few years and to step outside of the predominant educational philosophy, which is more constructivist, it's more play-based learning, it's more helping students to experiment and to, you know, helping them to make meaning out of their own stuff. I believe in all of that. I tend to believe in it middle school through high school. I've run inner city schools. One that the school district of Kenosha was going to close. I took those kids and taught them such rudimentary, basic skills stuff. At the same time, while having them go to Shakespearean plays, having them memorize classical poetry, and reading classical literature to them, so that I think it's possible to do both. But so I think part of it is whatever's necessary for in the way of curriculum instruction to help kids get caught up as early as possible. The family's a key to this. There is no solution to helping these students unless the parents are involved. My parents valued education. I document in there, my mother bought encyclopedias and things. She spearheaded our education. If parents aren't willing to do that, then they're complicit with the failure of their students. Along with that, I think morally the church has to be involved. I think that the church needs to set a standard for families too. It has to give them support, but support in this is how you parent. This is how you work with your kids, you know, in doing homework. Those kinds of practical things. So it's a multi-prong, you know, it's a battle where you're fighting a war on several fronts.
What are you doing now? You do online sermons. I've seen them, 7-minute sermons on Facebook.
I love the 7-minute sermon. even though they're getting longer than 7 minutes, at first I was like a savant in that I could sit there and I did one that was 6 minutes 59 seconds, and I don't use a clock. Uh-huh. Well, my internal clock has been off a little lately, but yeah, I love those because I love communicating the Bible in a very understandable, simple fashion. Same way Jesus did when he told the parables and things. What am I doing?
What are you doing? I mean, you've got the book, you've got your online presence, your sermons.
I pastor a church in Racine Sunday mornings, Livingstone's Charismatic Fellowship, an ad, 3001 Carpenter Avenue in Racine at 10 o'clock. You know, I interviewed for a few superintendencies in the last few months, didn't get them. Even assistant superintendencies were, you know, I guess I've been trained in a wide variety of things that a lot of superintendents haven't. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope that it's not a matter of you know, as I'm getting older, that it's not a matter of a different kind of discrimination mm-hmm. than race. But in reality, it could be because, you know, people have got to sit there and weigh, if we hire him, we may have him for 5 to 7 years. Do we believe he can move us forward enough as opposed to, you know, some guy that's in his 40s who, you know, can move us forward? So I understand that, but I find it troubling that, you know, that I'm unemployed. But I believe that the book has the potential to open opportunities for me to be able to write more. I've started a second book. I'm about 100 and some pages into it, called The Champions. And it's not exclusively about race. It's really about people who come into our lives at key points and who posture us towards success. They see potential in us. They give us dreams And they help us to move from inertia into a kind of momentum that determines our future. And some of the emphasis will be people of color, but not exclusively. History gives a lot of stories. I really, to be honest with you, I want the second half of the book to be more like Chicken Soup for the Soul. So I've already on my Facebook page put out a call to people. Look, here's what the book's about. Here's the kind of stories I'm looking for. If you've got that kind of story, either just write me a few paragraphs, give it to me generally, give me the poetic license to be able to, you know, the person who helped edit the book for me, she's wonderful when it comes to interviewing people. And on the second book, she's willing to sit down with people and to take their stories, record them, and then we'll write them into the book. So I believe and I'm hopeful that this will spearhead me into a different career, although I still am, still wouldn't mind having a job in education.
If you never worked as a superintendent again, would you be okay with that? Or would
if
you...
I could pay all my bills and everything?
If you could go ahead and be what you are now, literally today, a pastor, an author, go and maybe do speaking engagements, but not returning to education. Like, you don't feel like there's unfinished business, or you feel like you wanted to go out on a different note than what happened in Pulaski?
Well, I wanted to go out on a different note, you know, because I do have an ego and I care about my reputation. But no, if this proved to be successful, yeah, this would be, because I think what it does is, I think that what I'm doing now capitalizes on some of my strengths without having, even though there's a certain amount of politics in everything, being a superintendent is completely political. You know, you're working with other people, there are all sorts of agendas that are always going on, including your own. And you're trying to, you know, you're trying to get the passengers in and out of lifeboats at times on the Titanic. If you told me this is what God has for you for the rest of your life, and you're going to be successful at it, I would be content.
How important was it, and I'm just going to go back to Pulaski one more time, that final night, we talked about it when you came in, to see all those people in the community who came out to support you, to shake your hand, to give you a hug, tell you, to express to you how much you meant to them. Even in the worst of times, to have people reach out to you and support you like that, how does that make you feel?
You know, there are people of goodwill all over this country. And that night, I got to see people of goodwill. I got to see people who are fair-minded. They didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. They still, a lot of them still don't. It will be one of the high points of my life. It really will. Their hugs, their encouragement, because no one put a gun to their head to have them come. You know, as a matter of fact, some of the district employees were encouraged not to come. And yet they showed up regardless of that. So, you know, that's meaningful to me. That will always mean a lot to me. And I still have friends in Pulaski. And treasure their friendship. It means a lot. God bless those people who came out.
Where can people get the book?
Probably the two most prominent places to get the book, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. A lot of people have ordered from Amazon. An increasing number are ordering from Barnes & Noble. It's available on Nook. It's available on Kindle. There are a few reviews on Amazon. The people who've read it say that it's an interesting read. And I think, if nothing else, without reading the book of a famous person, in quotes, because I'm not a famous person, it probably gets people as close as they can to the life of just an average person. This is what it's like to have grown up in America as an African-American male over this period of time. Here are my experiences. They're not indicative of the experience of every African-American, or maybe even many African-Americans. But at least I think I pulled back the curtain a little bit to where people could see, you know, these are the emotions. These are the turmoil that people go through. And, you know, if it causes them, people have said, you challenged my thinking in the book. They could not have paid me a higher compliment, because that's what I want the book to do.
Do you feel like this can inspire others, not just to, as you mentioned, challenge their thinking, but also to look deeper into their own lives, whether it's with racism or whether it's religion or whether it's how they treat one another, how they parent, how they go through life, things like that? Do you find that that can be a tool for people to inspire them?
Yes. Yes. And there, and again, there are people who've come back to me and said that outside of just the topic of race, that this has challenged their faith and how they can live it out. You know, it's one thing to have a belief system that doesn't impact your attitudes and your behavior. To me, that's a worthless belief system, because your faith should impact everything you think, everything you do, every attitude that you have. And if it doesn't, then it's not doing what faith should do. So I'm hoping what it does. For some people, they're going to read it, and I'm hoping that for some of them who've been disappointed in the Christian faith and its reaction to some of these things, that it will get them to look again at the fact that faith can be a very valuable asset in navigating through not just the issue of race, but other issues in life. I'm hoping that it inspires some young people to have bigger dreams. I had bigger dreams when I was growing up. I'm hoping that it does the same thing for some of them, that where they, you know, they want to be a superintendent. They want to be the state superintendent of schools. They want to be the governor. I think I'm hoping that dealing with the issue of race does not disempower them and serve as a disincentive, and that when they're at the end of the book, they don't go, oh, it's a bummer, things are worse, why should I even try? But that it's more a, no, there's hope. There's hope. But there's hope, but you've got to navigate through the reefs so that your ship doesn't get shipwrecked. And, you know, so I'm hopeful of that as well.